Dave Andrew Radio Plays brings you The Whitechapel Murders File. This is an account of the horrible events of 1888, when a killer stalked the streets of London's East End, indiscriminately killing women and leaving a trail of terror in his wake. The Whitechapel Murders File recorded the deaths of 11 women, many of whom are regarded to be the victims of the infamous Jack the Ripper. The stories you are about to hear are real. The characters are real. The events are real. Take a step back in time to Victorian London and hear the stories that these poor women were unable to tell themselves. The Whitechapel Murders File, Episode 1. Poverty, overcrowding, homelessness, squalid living conditions, knife crime, unemployment, injustice, no faith in the authorities, no respect for the police, extreme prejudice, racial hatred. It all sounds very familiar. And you could be forgiven for thinking that I'm talking about life in the modern day. But you would be wrong. The problems we face in our 21st century lives are not so far removed from the problems our ancestors faced centuries ago. Only today we have the latest technology to divert us, entertain us, educate us, influence us, and, in some cases, condemn us. The passage of time sees old buildings giving way to new, street names being changed, horsepower replacing horses on our streets, fashions coming and going with the seasons, ever-expanding music genres, and technological advances which may, someday, make the human race redundant. In many ways, our life has changed beyond recognition since the 19th century, and, in no small part, because of it. It was the age of the Industrial Revolution and the Great Exhibition, which drew attention from all over the globe and was, in so many ways, a defining period for the country. But success does not come without a price, and that price was paid by the many thousands of poor people living and dying on the streets, forgotten, dispossessed, and exiled from polite society.
The tale of Victorian London was truly a tale of two cities. The affluence of the West End versus the abject poverty of the East End. A contrast which was to become uncomfortably apparent in the autumn of 1888, most notably in the Whitechapel area. People from all over the world migrated to Whitechapel and the surrounding areas, as it was very close to the docks. And in some cases, as is still apparent in the present time, people came here to escape oppression in their own countries, hoping to start a better life. Amongst those choosing to settle here was the Jewish community, who were poorly treated and mistrusted from the start. They were singled out because of their appearance, their beliefs, and their lifestyles, thought of as different and therefore to be hated. You see, we really haven't come too far from those unenlightened times. Victorian slums were home to those who were either out of work or on the lowest income. Financial support was only given as a supplement to those who were already working. There was no welfare state back then. You either earned money or you starved. Sometimes you starved anyway. Whole families not only had to share one room, some were also forced to sleep in the same beds too. The unsanitary conditions of the times ensured that death and disease was rife. The infant mortality rate was monumental. Only half the babies born to poor families lived beyond the age of 5 years old. Crime was out of control. Jobs were scarce, and conditions were extremely miserable for those who lived in the impoverished areas such as Whitechapel and its environs. Desperate times call for desperate measures, and women sometimes found that prostitution was the only way which they could feed their children. With the close proximity of the docks, there was never a shortage of clientele. In so many ways, this was as dangerous for them physically as it was soul-destroying. Each became a target for abuse, and all of them were highly likely to contract a very nasty sexually transmitted disease. The dangers were to become all too evident when a monster emerged from the shadows to mercilessly slaughter women and leave his legacy of fear, which struck at the very heart of the empire. A person who shall be known throughout history as Jack the Ripper.
The Whitechapel Murders File is a passion project which has been a long time in the making, and one which could not have been completed without the help of good friends and family. I am not a ripperologist, neither would I claim to be an authority on the subject. Indeed, all my research has been obtained from dedicated websites, Wikipedia and books, not least The Five by Hayley Rubenhold. Like her, it's my intention to focus on the women and not speculate on who their murderer or murderers may have been. There is already so much focus upon that, it was more important for me to highlight the women, concentrate on who they were. Throughout this journey, I feel I've got to know them a little, and I've genuinely been touched by their stories, which have made me sad and angry in equal measure. It is my sincere wish that I do justice to these poor women throughout this podcast. God knows they never got any for what happened to them. I hope that sharing their stories with you will bring them to life a little more and help you to realise that they were always more than just names or bit part players in the greatest mystery the world has ever known. The Whitechapel Murders File was a document created at the time of the Jack the Ripper murders, which plagued London's East End throughout the autumn of 1888. It is generally agreed that only five of the victims, now referred to as the canonical five, a term which was first used in 1987 by the late author, researcher and scholar Martin Fido, were the work of the Ripper. However, 11 names appear on the file, and the modus operandi used in some of the non-canonical murders bore a striking resemblance to those attributed to the Ripper.
The first name recorded is that of Emma Elizabeth Smith, who was brutally attacked whilst returning to her lodgings in the early hours of the 4th of April, 1888.
My name is Emma Elizabeth Smith, and I was born in a place called Stoke Damerel, Devon, on Christmas Day, 1843. I was one of six children, and my parents were Thomas and Emma Binsmore. I really don't remember much about my childhood, other than it could be crowded and noisy sometimes. I moved to Hampshire sometime before 1862 and met a man who was to become my first husband, Frederick Augustus Churcher Wells. We were married on Portsea Island in April 1862. I don't really have much more to say about that, other than the marriage didn't last. On September the 1st, 1868, I married for a second time, my new husband being John Smith, and the ceremony took place at St Mary's Church, Portsea. I thought that everything was going to be fine, but then John died, leaving me a widow. I don't really remember how it happened, nor why, but I disassociated myself from all my family, cutting myself off from them. I knew that I couldn't stay on Portsea Island without John, so I made the long journey to London, finding myself in Spitalfields, which was unlike any place I'd ever known before. It took me a long time to get used to the change in lifestyle. I had never experienced the lack of security before, and it was terrifying how much I had to adapt. I took up lodgings at 18 George Street, where I met some nice people, and a lot more people who were far from nice. It was a struggle for survival most of the time, and you had to find the money to pay for your room, for food, and to keep your clothes looking nice. I suppose we all have to do things we don't want to do in order to survive sometimes. When necessity dictates, it takes away your choices. Like everything else, you get used to your conditions after a while, although I freely admit that alcohol made it easier for me to cope. I have found out that I am not a very good drunk as well. I don't normally see myself as a violent nor aggressive person, but I have been known to fight like a cat when the drink is on me. I went out on the evening of 3rd of April 1888. I cannot recall whether it was specifically to meet somebody, but it was good to get out and take the evening air. I stopped to talk to a man at the junction of Brick Lane and Osborne Street. I remember that he was wearing dark clothing, which was offset by a white scarf. At about 12:15 on the morning of 4th of April, I saw my neighbour, Margaret Hayes, and acknowledged her. I wasn't ready to return home at that stage, so I continued talking with this man, after which I walked on alone. I was only 300 yards from my lodging house when I was approached by three men whom I'd never seen before. They blocked my path and would not let me pass and were using profane language to me, shouting at me and being aggressive. I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. It was then that they attacked me. I didn't know what was happening at first, but then they dragged me to the ground and started to take my undergarments down. I was shouting at them to stop. I couldn't fight them off. One of them forced an object inside me, and it hurt me so much I thought I would pass out. I have never felt fear nor pain like that in my life before, and I kept asking them to stop, but they just carried on hurting me. The attack lasted for what seemed like ages, and I couldn't move. I felt so very sore, and I knew that I was bleeding. I couldn't really describe them, only that one was no more than a boy, certainly a young teenager. When they finished, they ran away, leaving me lying on the cold ground. I knew that I couldn't stay there, so I forced myself to get up, which was not easy, as I was in such pain. I was bleeding so heavily from the damage they had caused me that I needed to use my clothing to stem the flow. Somehow, I managed to get back to the lodging house, where Mary Russell, the deputy housekeeper, saw me, and she was shocked and horrified at the state I was in. With the help of another resident, Annie Lee, she immediately took me to the London Hospital on Whitechapel Road. I just needed to lie down. Maybe if I went to sleep, it would all prove to be a very real and very bad dream. Sadly, it wasn't a dream. I was seen by the duty house surgeon, George Hazlitt, who could not disguise the look of concern on his face. I was so tired. I just wanted to close my eyes, but he was asking me questions which I did my best to answer. The rush of darkness came for me, and I could no longer stay awake. I don't remember anything which happened after that.
Emma Elizabeth Smith slipped into a coma and died from her injuries at 9 a.m. on the morning of the 4th of April, 1888. A subsequent inquest determined that she was murdered by person or persons unknown. Hers is the first name on the Whitechapel murders file. No suspects were ever found. And as with all the other victims, she has never received any justice for the atrocity which befell her. Little appears to be known about her early life, but it is considered that she was born for better things than she ultimately received. Indeed, Walter Drew, who was a serving detective constable at the time of her murder, wrote of her.
Her past was a closed book, even to her intimate friends. All she had ever told anyone about herself was that she was a widow who, more than 10 years before, had left her husband and broken away from all her early associations. There was something about Emma Smith which suggested that there had been a time when the comforts of life had not been denied her. There was a touch of culture in her speech, unusual in her class.
Once, when Emma was asked why she had broken away so completely from her old life, she replied a little wistfully,
They would not understand now any more than they understood then. I must live somehow.
It is thought that she cut all ties with her family and that she had a son and daughter who were living somewhere near Finsbury Park, London.
A medical investigation, which was conducted by Dr. G.H. Miller, concluded that a blunt object had been inserted so violently into her that it ruptured her peritoneum. However, Emma may have been forced to live, and whatever questionable decisions she had to make in her life, nothing can ever justify the savage way in which it was ended. She was laid to rest on April the 28th, 1888, in Merton, southwest London.
What did I do wrong? Remember me.
The second name entered on the Whitechapel murders file is that of Martha Tabram, also known as Martha Turner.
Hello, my name is Martha Tabram, and I was born at 17 Marshall Street, Southwark, London, on the 10th of May, 1849. My parents were Charles Samuel White, a warehouseman, and Elizabeth Dowsett. I was the youngest of five children, and it was fun to be the baby of the family. I don't have very many memories of my early childhood, to be honest. We were never well off, but we got by. When I grew up, I met a man named Samuel Tabram, who'd been working as a furniture packer. He was the first man I really fell in love with, and we got married at Trinity Church in Newington on Christmas Day, 1869. As chance would have it, we moved into 20 Marshall Street, almost in touching distance of the house I was born in. Our first son, Frederick John, was born in 1871, and he was followed by our second son, Charles Henry, a year later. I can't really remember a time when I didn't like to drink. It became such a natural part of my life that before I knew it, I had become dependent on it. When I drank too much, I would sometimes have fits, which frightened and upset my family, and it also scared me. I could see that Samuel was becoming more and more distant and disappointed, so much so that our marriage came to an end in 1875. I left the family with only the clothes I wore on my back. I had no income and had to rely on the 12 shillings a week that Samuel had to pay me in support. He wasn't faltering in this until I met a carpenter by the name of Henry Turner, and against my better wishes, I fell for him. When we began to live together, Samuel reduced his payments from 12 shillings a week to 2 shillings per week from then on. My relationship with Henry was very stormy at times. We always rubbed each other up the wrong way, but we always seemed to find one another again following a brief period of separation. But the last time we broke up, though, was the last time. We were never given a chance to reconcile. I had a friend by the name of Mary Ann Connolly, although we all knew her as Pearly Poll. She could be a bit of a wildcat sometimes, and we would get up to all sorts of mischief together. On the night of August the 6th, 1888, Poll and I had been drinking with a couple of soldier boys in the Angel and Crown pub at 5 Whitechapel Road, where we spent the evening. When it was time for us to leave, we decided to pair off with our soldier boys and see what happened from there. I was only getting 2 shillings a week, and that would not pay for a night's board around here. They always used to say that needs must when the devil drives, and the devil was certainly in Whitechapel that night. I know this because I was to meet him before the night was through. Poll and her soldier wandered off down Angel Alley, whilst my soldier and me made our way to Gunthorpe Street and walked towards George Yard Buildings. I noticed that he was quiet when we left the pub, and he'd been so different when we'd all been together, and I suppose I was hoping that he'd changed his mind and he would just say good night and make his way back to the barracks. But as we got to the entrance of George Yard Buildings, he steered me towards it. Nothing could have prepared me for what was about to happen. It was like he'd gone mad. I tried to pull away from him and screamed out, "Murder!" But he was so much stronger than I was. I couldn't fight him off. I felt a very sharp pain, followed by a moment of disbelief, after which I I felt nothing at all.
John Reeves, a resident of the block, was on his way to work at about 4:45 in the morning when he discovered Martha's body. The light was not bright enough at that time to reveal the pool of blood she was lying in, and he would not have been immediately certain whether she was drunk or dead. He left George Yard Buildings but returned a short while later with Police Constable Barrett, who then took command of the situation.
Her body was examined by Dr. Timothy Robert Killeen at about 5:30 that morning. He concluded that she would have been dead for about 3 hours, which fits in with the time Mrs. Hewitt and the two other residents claimed to have heard her cry of murder. Martha had been stabbed 39 times in the body, throat and internal organs. She was lying on her back and her clothing had been raised to her midriff, bearing a striking resemblance to the modus operandi employed in later murders, which were attributed to Jack the Ripper. Opinion has always been divided as to whether Martha was in fact the first known Ripper victim. Certainly this was a view shared by Inspector Walter Dew in his autobiography, in which he writes,
"Whatever may be said about the death of Emma Smith, there can be no doubt that the August bank holiday murder, which took place in George Yard Buildings, was the handiwork of the dread Ripper."
Criminologists and Ripperologists will spend the rest of eternity debating this point.
In today's world, Martha would have been seen as an addict, somebody who needed help to control her reliance on alcohol. The fact that she was prone to fits when too much alcohol had been consumed was very worrying for her continued health, both physically and mentally. She would be offered treatment, counselling, or advocacy, which may have helped her to understand her illness well enough to start taking control of it.
Nobody has the right to treat anybody in the vicious and disgusting way her murderer or the murderer of any other victims did. It is almost beyond belief to think that anybody could be capable of carrying out such a vicious attack. But sadly, Martha was far from the first, and she is definitely not the last.
Although, with the aid of Pearly Poll, barracks were visited and identification parades undertaken for would-be suspects, none was ever found. The location of Martha's grave has not been identified to me at this time, but it is assumed that it lies within one of the East End cemeteries.
Martha Tabron, 10th of May, 1849 to the 7th of August, 1888.
What did you do that for? Remember me.
Episode 1 featured Sharon Preston as Emma Smith and Caroline Tattersall as Martha Tabram. Narration was by Sarah Robinson, Daniel O'Rorty, and Dave Andrew. Excerpts from Nimrod by Elgar and Lament by Frederick Magel were provided courtesy of YouTube, as was the title music, which was created by the Power Music Factory, and the end music, The Watermill, which was composed by Ronald Binge. This production was devised and produced by Dave Andrew, using historic documents and reports from the time, along with information gleaned from dedicated websites, books, and documentaries. Thank you for listening. Please join us again for episode 2.